Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. On Friday of this week, Jan Crawford Greenberg, who is the Supreme Court reporter for the Chicago Tribune and the regular commentator on the courts for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, will be here at 11 o'clock. She is a very articulate, extremely well-informed analyst of the action of the court, plans to speak on recent decisions of the court, on cases that are being argued now, and on the confirmation process. So I'd certainly invite everyone who is interested in what the Supreme Court is up to come to this forum. That will be the last forum before we break for the Christmas holiday. Dr. Frederick G. Hayden, who is the Stuart S. Richardson Professor of Clinical Virology in Internal Medicine and Professor of Internal Medicine and Pathology at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, has published widely and deeply about respiratory viral infections, antivirals, and vaccines. His publications, in fact, take 45 single-space pages to list. Educated at Stanford University and trained in Rochester, New York at Strong Memorial Hospital and the University of Rochester School of Medicine, Fred Hayden was appointed to the faculty of the University of Virginia in 1978. It is not hyperbolic to say that Dr. Hayden has received every major academic and professional honor available to those in his specialty. He serves as a consultant to the World Health Organization and is of internationally recognized stature. No public health topic is of greater moment than responding to the threat of a pandemic influenza, and I'm honored to welcome Dr. Frederick Hayden.
Well, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's really a pleasure to join you this morning, and especially to see familiar faces in the audience. It's great to be among friends. What I'd like to try to do is give you first some sense of the threat posed by pandemic influenza, and then turn to a consideration of the response side, how we're doing with regard to vaccines and antivirals in particular. Now, the word pandemic derives from the Greek word pandemos, meaning all the people. And this is a situation then where we can anticipate a viral disease affecting individuals on a worldwide basis across the age spectrum, all of the people. Now, for this to happen, there are a number of specific changes in virus and its epidemiology need to take place. First, there has to be the appearance of a novel influenza A strain that for which the population possesses either little or basically no immunity, and furthermore, a virus that can, of course, infect individuals and cause disease in them. And finally, a key element is the ability of this virus then to transmit easily from one person to another. Now, all of these things have already taken place with regard to avian influenza, except the last. And that's why there's such concern currently with regard to the threat of pandemic influenza. Now, of course, this has generated a lot of media attention, and I could show you any number of examples. Some of this is less restrained than others, but I think that a lot of it is, in fact, justified. And one of the things that particularly concerns me, in fact, that this is the Chinese year of the rooster. And those of you who are familiar with this as a potential source, and unfortunately, next year is the Chinese year of the pig, so that we're not out of the woods yet. Now, this is, of course, a time of year where we like to put together lists, and the World Health Organization has put together a list of the 10 things that you need to know about pandemic influenza. So first is that pandemic influenza is different from avian flu. We have avian flu now. These are sporadic human infections when the virus crosses a species barrier into humans. Pandemic influenza will occur when that virus has adapted to humans so that it can spread efficiently and then go on a global basis. Pandemics of influenza are recurring events. We had three in the 20th century and probably 10 to 12 in the preceding 300 years in total. So, in fact, this will happen. It's inevitable. It's just a matter of when. The World Health would indicate that the world may be on the brink of another pandemic. Currently, all countries will be affected, not surprisingly, again, given the nature of what a pandemic really is, and widespread illness will occur. All of these things are self-evident from the fact that, again, this is a virus that will affect all persons basically across the age spectrum on a global basis. When this happens, medical supplies will be inadequate. There'll be large numbers of deaths. It's hard to know how many, but I'll give you some of the statistics in just a moment. And there will be great economic and social disruption associated with that. So that every country must be prepared, not only the United States, but the rest of the world. And of course, we're all in this together. This is going to be an international event of really historic proportion. The World Health will help. They will alert the world when the pandemic threat increases. Unfortunately, I can tell you from interacting with colleagues at the World Health Organization, their ability to actually provide interventions is relatively limited, although I'll get back to that in a few moments. To put some numbers on this for you, this is from the most recent Health and Human Services Pandemic Plan publication that tried to project what would happen if we had a 1918-like event without interventions. We can anticipate that roughly 30% of the population would develop an influenza illness. Half of these would seek medical care. About 1 in 10 would be hospitalized. And a substantial proportion of them, of course, require intensive care unit support, mechanical ventilation, and deaths of maybe as many as 2 million then in the United States alone. You can, of course, then extrapolate that to what might happen on a global basis when you consider there are now over 6 billion people in the world. Now, where do these viruses come from? Let me take a few moments to give you a brief primer on influenza viruses. And this is a schematic of what an influenza A virus looks like. You'll notice that the surface of the virus is decorated by two major proteins, the HA or hemagglutinin, and the NA or neuraminidase. Now, the hemagglutinin is the portion that most of our immune responses generated by vaccines are directed against. It's also the proportion of the virus that changes most readily. Frequent changes, are known as antigenic drift, occur on an annual, every 2 to 3 year basis. The neuraminidase is important in terms of viral replication, but it's also the target of one class of our antiviral drugs, the neuraminidase inhibitors, and I'll get back to those in just a few moments. Now, you notice that inside the virus is a genome that's composed of 8 different segments. And this is one of the unique properties of this virus in that it has this segmented genome. This allows the virus then, when it duly infects a susceptible cell or host, to swap genetic elements. This is as close to sex as viruses get, as a matter of fact. So this is a schematic, again, that depicts how this plays out, where one particular virus donates 6 gene segments, the other 2 gene segments, one of which encodes the hemagglutinin, the other the neuraminidase, to generate a new virus strain then. Now, this is the strategy that's actually used to make vaccines currently, both the injected as well as the intranasal vaccine. But it's also the way in which novel influenza viruses may emerge, this reassortment of gene segments. Now, the other thing you need to know about influenza virus, in particular the influenza A viruses, is that they're not uniquely human pathogens. In fact, the aquatic birds of the world are the major reservoir for influenza A viruses. And there are up to 16 different hemagglutinin subtypes, 9 different neuraminidase subtypes that are recognized in these migratory birds, particularly ducks. So far in humans, we've only seen widespread infection by hemagglutinins numbered 1 through 3, but the potential exists then from this vast reservoir of genetic material for the generation of other pandemic strains. And what's happened recently, of course, is transmissions from these migratory birds into domestic fowl and then sporadically into humans. Now, the Swine may play an important role in some of this reassortment that I described earlier, because they actually have the receptors on their cells for both human and avian influenza viruses, and so they can serve then as a potential mixing vessel for the generation of strains that can go into humans. We also think that in 1918, that human viruses went into swine, and so that they're susceptible potentially to our viruses as well. So let's look back at what happened in the 20th century for a few moments to try to again address this question, where do these viruses come from? Of course, 1918 was the most dramatic event, with upwards of 40 million deaths worldwide. Other estimates would put that closer to maybe 100 million deaths, 675,000 individuals in the United States, a shortening of the average lifespan in the United States by about 12 to 13 years, really a catastrophic event. The so-called milder pandemics in 57 with Asian flu, which had rough anywhere from 1 to 4 million deaths, and then in 1968 with Hong Kong flu, again, were lesser in their impact, but still very substantial events on a worldwide basis. But it's really 1918 that is viewed as the worst case scenario, and the kind of event that we're concerned about, again, occurring with avian influenza. There have been a number of recent publications on this, and this is just one example of the kinds of care that were given under emergency conditions in both hospitals, but also military camps around the country. Remember, of course, this is occurring at a time when troops are being mobilized and transported to Europe to fight in World War I. Indeed, in the American Expeditionary Force, there are more deaths due to influenza and pneumonia than there were to battlefield casualties. And one of the unique things about the 1918 experience was the very high mortality in young and middle-aged adults for reasons that really are not still well understood. In one of these camps, Camp Jackson in South Carolina, influenza entered in middle of September. There were over 10,000 illnesses and over 400 deaths among the 38,000 recruits that were in that particular camp. One of these, a private named Roscoe Vaughn, developed illness shortly after the introduction of the virus into the camp, starting with typical flu symptoms of fever and aches and pains. However, he went on to develop pneumonia, which was the dreaded complication of influenza, and then succumbed on the 26th of September, and in fact, the day that Pershing launched the Meuse-Argonne campaign in Europe. Now, at that time, the medical system was much more aggressive and fastidious about getting autopsy data to try to understand what the cause of this and other problems might be. And so he underwent an autopsy. A lung sample was collected, preserved in formalin, and then sent to the Army Medical Museum, now known as the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. And there it sat for a large number of years until a colleague in that institution named Jeffrey Taubenberger tried to pull a group of samples that had been maintained since 1918 to see if he could resurrect elements of that virus to understand why it had such unique lethality. And indeed, it was Roscoe Vaughn's sample from which the first positive signal was obtained, where they were able to get partial sequences of the influenza genome. I'm not sure if you've seen pictures of Jeffrey Taubenberger, but he's a remarkable talent who has gone on then to, with help from other colleagues, getting samples from individuals who died in Alaska and were frozen in the permafrost, also exhuming some bodies in London where there was good preservation. He's been able to get all now of the influenza virus genetic material from 1918 and reconstruct that virus. And what's been learned is that the 1918 virus had an avian influenza virus for all of its gene segments as the ancestor. So all of the gene segments derived from an avian source. There wasn't a reassortment with a human virus, as far as he can discern. The virus, when put into animals under experimental conditions, grows exuberantly. There are very high titers of the virus in the lungs. It causes a necrotizing bronchitis and pneumonia, and of course, a substantial lethality. And this is without adaptation, just putting the virus straight into these small animal hosts. Furthermore, it's been determined that all of the genes of that virus contribute to its unique lethality and its virulence in terms of high growth characteristics, but in particular, the hemagglutinin is essential for severe lung injury. And it's possible actually to take just the hemagglutinin from the 1918 virus and put it into the backbone of a human virus and infect animals and cause lethal pneumonia. So there's something special about that particular hemagglutinin. And then finally, what's been learned to date, and there's more study going on, of course, is that relatively small number of changes in these different genes, particularly the hemagglutinin and the polymerase proteins, allowed that virus to become adapted to its mammalian host. So it didn't take a lot of change for an avian influenza virus to become adapted to a human host and then result in a pandemic. So in terms of where these viruses come from, there are three basic answers. First, there can be a reassortment of genes between an animal, specifically an avian, and a human virus. And this, in fact, did occur to generate both the 1957 and 68 pandemics. There can be recirculation of a human virus from a stable reservoir. And this probably accounted for the Russian flu in 1977. It probably came out of somebody's laboratory or in the context of experiments done looking at the production of live attenuated vaccines. And then finally, we have this possibility of direct interspecies transmission from an animal, particularly a bird, to a human host. This again appeared to occur in 1918 and is one of the major concerns with regard to avian influenza. So let me turn to the topic at hand then in terms of bird flu. What's next? Well, I wish I could answer that for you. I am among those who are very concerned about what's transpiring right now with regard to this epizootic of avian influenza in bird populations in large parts of the world. And in Southeast Asia is, of course, the place where one would have expected such an event to occur. It's really been the epicenter for previous influenza pandemics, and part of this relates to the high concentrations of poultry and their close contact with human and swine populations in that area. So just to reiterate, again, influenza A viruses have migratory water birds as their primary reservoir. These can then be transmitted to domestic poultry, undergo antigenic change and also enhancement and virulence to become what are known as so-called fall plague viruses, and then these can be transmitted to humans. Now, this first was recognized to have occurred in 1997 in Hong Kong when there were 18 cases of the H5N1 infection recognized with six deaths, so a 33% case fatality rate, a very lethal infection indeed. But now, is I think in part because people are looking more carefully, seen a number of instances, not just with H5, but with H9, H7 viruses crossing that species barrier into humans, so that we don't know whether it'll be H5 in the future. It might be one of these other viruses or even a reappearance of an older virus like the H2 that caused the Asian pandemic in 1957. But what we do know, of course, is that the H5 virus is continuing to spread on a global basis, being carried on migratory pathways by these wild birds, so that there's now documentation of ongoing infection in birds in Europe and the Middle East, with new outbreaks being recognized in Romania, the Crimea, Ukraine, Romania, and a real concern that this virus is going to be carried, as you can see, into sub-Saharan Africa, and in fact, not shown in the slide, these migratory routes overlap up in Siberia and Alaska. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Rob Webster, who's really the world's expert in this area, has predicted that this H5 virus will probably reach North America within the next year, so that we'll have it in our own continent and be confronted by this ongoing threat. So clearly we're seeing a virus that's spreading in bird populations and exposing increased numbers of human beings. This is a highly pathogenic avian influenza virus. The hemagglutinin has a particular sequence in it that allows it to be activated to an infectious form by cellular proteases that are present not only in the respiratory tract, but in other organs in the body, so that in the infected birds, these highly pathogenic viruses spread throughout the body, infecting multiple viscera and causing high mortality. In addition, they replicate in the gut. And this is typical, really, of all avian influenza viruses, and then are put out in the feces to contaminate the environment. And one of the things that's been recognized recently with the H5 viruses, in fact, their hardiness for survival in the environment it appears to be increasing, so that under the right conditions, they can survive literally for weeks in the environment and then be there to infect either birds or potentially an exposed human. The viruses in general do not cause lethal infections in ducks, so that they can serve as an asymptomatic reservoir to infect other species, but some of them, in fact, have changed to the point where they actually have caused mortality in ducks as well as the migratory birds themselves. Of particular concern is that the H5 virus is showing an enhanced pathogenicity for mammalian hosts. We know that in the laboratory, it can cause disseminated infection in mice, in ferrets, where the virus spreads from the lung to the central nervous system and other viscera. It's shown an expanded host range, infecting swine in felids in multiple countries. There, of course, was the well-documented outbreak in Thailand in a zoo where they had fed raw and infected chickens to the tigers and leopards, and then this virus had caused infections that were transmitted to other tigers within those zoo circumstances. Fortunately, so far, this virus has shown inefficient human-to-human transmission, but there have been well-documented cases now of transmission within families under close contact conditions, and we know that this can, again, be demonstrated both in the laboratory and in the field among cats. With regard to human cases, most of these have clustered in Vietnam and Thailand. The green dots show you the more recent cases that have occurred in the past few months, and so we've now seen new human cases from China, and this is probably a minimal estimate on the numbers there, as well as in Indonesia, and ongoing sporadic cases in Thailand, in Vietnam. The numbers are not large so far. If you consider that there have been over 150 million birds affected and killed, we're at 135 human cases in aggregate, with a mortality rate just over 50% among the recognized cases. But still, every human case is an opportunity for the virus to learn how to change its ability to spread from person to person. Now, for those of you who want to delve into this more deeply, I would refer you to this publication at the end of September in the New England Journal of Medicine. We had a meeting in Hanoi where all the different clinicians who have helped to care for these patients were brought together to review their experience, and it's laid out here in this particular article with regard to the presentation and the findings in human infections due to H5 infection. For those of you who might be considering travel to one of the affected areas, I just wanted to point out that right now there are no travel restrictions as of today based on CDC or World Health Organization recommendations. If you go there, obviously avoid exposure. We wash your hands. If soap and water aren't available, carry alcohol gel with you. Don't go to markets where there might be live poultry or farms or places where you might be exposed to birds or to surfaces that have been contaminated by bird excreta. I would urge you to get the conventional influenza vaccine for this season to protect yourself, because there's still plenty of human influenza out there as well. And this is a personal recommendation about carrying oseltamivir, trade name Tamiflu, with you. Not taking it, but have it available, because if there were an exposure situation where you needed the drug, you may not be able to get it in the country where you're traveling. And this is specifically for countries where there is recognized human influenza, the ones that I mentioned earlier. So where do we stand right now? The WHO has this pandemic alert scale, and we're now in phase three, where there have been human infections by a novel virus, but only rare instances have spread to contacts. There are two other phases you can see before we get to phase six, where there's sustained person-to-person transmission. All I can say is that change from phase three to phase six we don't know how fast that might occur. It could take months or years. It could happen in weeks, potentially. That's just an unknown right now. So where do we stand with on the preparedness side? This is a quote from the Institute of Medicine in 2003. Despite the certainty of a pandemic, even the developed countries of the world are quite unprepared for such an event. The public health infrastructure is inadequate, hospitals lack the capacity to accommodate a surge of patients, and the repertoire of antiviral drugs is completely inadequate. Not good news, and I can tell you that things haven't improved a lot since 2003. If you look at, for example, hospital bed capacity on a worldwide basis, Switzerland and Japan are at the top of the list in terms of rank order in beds per 1,000 population. They actually have about four times as many as we do in the United States, where you can see we're down at 46 on a international scale. So that we don't really have the ability to care for large numbers of patients because we've been so effective at constraining hospital bed size and medical care costs. And this is going to be a real problem even now when we have a bigger than average influenza seasonal outbreak. With regard to specific modalities then that could be used to mitigate the impact of a pandemic, let me start first with vaccines. Our vaccine technology really dates to the 1940s, and we still use embryonated hen's eggs to grow the vast majority of influenza vaccine that's used on a global scale. These are data from David Fedson, who was faculty here at the university for a number of years and then has been working with a company that's involved with vaccine manufacture in Europe recently. In looking at the global vaccine supply in the year 2000, he estimated there were about total production of about 235 million doses at that time. This has probably now increased to about 300 million doses. Most of it is produced in Europe, as a matter of fact, and 85% of vaccine production is actually concentrated in just nine countries, again, mostly in Europe, and to a lesser extent, North America, Australia, and New Zealand. with regard to pandemic response, bear in mind that the standard amount of hemagglutinin in our conventional vaccine is 15 micrograms per virus type. So we have a trivalent vaccine now with three different viruses in it, so that's 45 micrograms of viral hemagglutinin. So if you assume a 3-to-1 dose ratio, if you're just trying to develop a monovalent vaccine for a single pandemic threat virus, this would indicate that we could produce up to 900 million doses. The problem is that because this is a unique virus for which people don't have pre-existing immunity, it's quite likely that they would require two doses of vaccine, just as we need in young children to get them properly immunized against influenza. So that that cuts that amount of vaccine available down to 450 million doses at best. And again, balancing that against the 6 billion people that we have worldwide, that means we have less than a vaccine for less than 10% of the world's population currently. There's another problem with H5s in particular, in that it's a relatively poor immunogen. And this is a study done with a non-pathogenic H5 virus back in the late 90s after the Hong Kong virus was first detected. And what was found is that a non-adjuvanted vaccine, the type that we currently use in our conventional seasonal immunization strategy, even given in two doses, induced no immune responses. That's shown on the right-hand side of this figure. There were no boosts in antibody titer. It was only when they combined it with an adjuvant, this one specifically known as MF59, that there were slight to modest antibody responses. So it took two doses of vaccine plus an adjuvant to get partial immune responses that may have been partially protective. Now, you've probably read about progress that's been made more recently in the United States with regard to generation of a pandemic vaccine. Dr. Fauci from the National Institutes of Health announced that the vaccine, in fact, was effective in initial human testing, and indeed, it is immunogenic. The problem is, and the data haven't been published yet, that it takes a lot of viral hemagglutinin. And this is an older study that illustrates, again, that point, where what was recognized with an earlier variety of an H5 vaccine is that it took two doses of 90 micrograms in order to get an effective immune response, and that's that dashed white line up above. That's the threshold for protection as we think is currently required. It took two doses to get that immune response in just over half of the volunteers who participated in the study. So that 90 micrograms times two is 180 micrograms, or four times as much as is in current trivalent vaccine. It shows you that this is really not a feasible vaccine approach for large portions of the population. We just can't make that much vaccine currently. And so there's a lot of work going on right now to develop more immunogenic vaccines using, again, adjuvants to get around this problem. Now, fortunately, in terms of the bird population, the H5 vaccines do work. If they're good vaccines, relatively small doses will be protective. And as you're aware, China has recently announced its plans to immunize its 14 billion poultry. That's a monumental undertaking, of course, but at least there is the possibility with veterinary vaccines to do source control, to try to dampen the ongoing outbreaks in the animals and hopefully then reduce the likelihood of a pandemic in humans from occurring. Let me turn to the antivirals. Not sure if you can read this. This is a classic Gary Larson cartoon. Quit complaining and eat it. Number one, chicken soup is good for the flu. And number two, it's nobody we know. Now, in fact, we can do a little bit better than this now with regard to the drug side of this, but I wouldn't want to at all denigrate the possibility that chicken soup would be helpful. My laboratory has worked extensively over the years on testing of antiviral drugs for influenza. And currently, in most countries of the world, there are two classes of drugs that are available. The older ones, the M2 inhibitors, which are active just for influenza A viruses and have been around really for over 30 years. And then the newer class of neuraminidase inhibitors with zanamivir, the inhaled form, and oral oseltamivir being the two commercially available agents in this class, both of which were approved in the United States in 1999. Now, the older class was actually studied in the 1968 pandemic and the 1977 pandemic-like event. And what was learned there is that, indeed, if you take these drugs during the period when the virus is circulating in the community, you can be protected at a very high level of efficacy against the development of influenza illness. And the protective efficacy in different studies is illustrated here, and there were a number that were done in each of these periods of time. But on average, it was about a 70% reduction in the likelihood that one would develop an influenza illness, which is, again, a significant level of protection. And indeed, we know now, based on the studies that have been done in the interpandemic period with the neuraminidase inhibitors, that they would be at least as protective, if not more so, than the older studies done with amantadine. That information has been used then to look at the possibility of actually containing a pandemic with antiviral drugs. And this has been done through the use of mathematical models. And what's depicted here is a projected outbreak of an H5N1 virus in Thailand, starting in a rural area of Thailand in a village somewhere, and then spreading over a period of days. And the days are illustrated so that it starts slowly over a month or two, but then you can see by day 90, 3 months in, there's a that red area shows the new cases occurring. It's really spreading like a wildfire across all of Thailand. And once it gets into the major cities like Bangkok, of course, it's going to take off dramatically. And then gradually, as the susceptibles are exhausted, the green areas indicate the people who have recovered from their infection or succumbed to it. And this is projection with a virus that spreads at only a moderate level of efficiency, not one that's highly transmissible from person to person. So this is that gives you some sense of the time frame. Now, if one intervenes with what's known as geographically targeted chemoprophylaxis, you can change that to what's depicted here on the right with this with the blue dots, where there is a localized outbreak, but it's contained. This all sounds very promising until you consider all the caveats that apply to this strategy of ring chemoprophylaxis. It has to be geographically targeted in a non-urban setting. If the virus breaks out in a major urban setting, it's already a circumstance where it's beyond control. The intervention has to be begun early, within 1 to 3 weeks of recognizing an evolving cluster of human cases. And the virus has to behave. It has to be one of low to at most moderate transmissibility. And this is measured by a factor known as the R-naught. In general, we think that the 1918 virus, for example, had an R-naught of somewhere between 1.8 and maybe 3. So it has to be a relatively low transmissibility risk. One has to give chemoprophylaxis to upwards of 90% of the population of that area, plus you have to restrict their movement. You can't allow them to leave, and so that their strategies of movement restriction and social distancing have to be enforced, along with, of course, compliance with the drug, otherwise it won't really work. Now, these mathematical models would indicate that we would need a maximum of 3 million courses to do this. That's not a lot of drug. And in fact, as little as 300,000 may be sufficient if you get there early enough. The problem is really the rapid identification and intervention. And that's where I think there's some major hurdles that would need to be overcome. Now, on the treatment side, we do know that in studies of human influenza, that early treatment with a drug like oseltamivir, Tamiflu, can make a real difference in terms of not only symptom relief, but reducing complications, and also, as shown here, reducing the need for hospitalization in the month after an influenza diagnosis. So in our analysis of comparing placebo recipients to oseltamivir, we found that in both healthy adults, as well as in high-risk and elderly individuals, that the likelihood of a hospitalization was diminished by about half if they got early treatment with the antiviral drug as compared to placebo. And if one can reduce hospitalizations, of course, that should translate into a reduction in lethality as well. And indeed, recent retrospective analyses of very large insurance databases in the United States have found, again, reductions in pneumonia, myocardial infarction, and importantly, death from any cause in the 30 days after an influenza diagnosis among those who got oseltamivir compared to no antiviral treatment. Indeed, you can see the numbers at the bottom there in terms of mortality. There's only one death among nearly 40,000 oseltamivir recipients compared to 56 among those who were untreated. And the point estimate then for efficacy in terms of reducing the likelihood of death was 91%, a very substantial level of protection. Now, unfortunately, we haven't realized that with H5N1 infections so far. The virus is susceptible in the laboratory. The drug is fully active in cell culture and animal models, but when you look at actually what's happened with oseltamivir treatment in the field, in Vietnam, in Thailand, the proportion of individuals who are surviving is really similar, 25% basically, whether or not they got oseltamivir treatment in this analysis. The problem is the patients are coming in late. They're coming in when the pneumonia is already established, when they've already had extensive lung damage to take place. There's also an issue of the development of antiviral resistance to these drugs. And this has been seen particularly with the older class, the M2 inhibitors, where if one looks at virus coming recovered from individuals during therapy, we can see resistant virus coming up in anywhere from 30 to as many as 80% of treated individuals. The frequency of resistance emergence with oseltamivir is substantially lower, but you can see that in inpatient children in a study in Japan that 18%, over about 1 in 5 then, had a resistant virus detected during that treatment course of oseltamivir. Now, with the M2 inhibitors, we know that those viruses that are resistant are fully transmissible from person to person. They cause typical influenza. They have no loss of biologic fitness. The evidence with oseltamivir is more encouraging. Here, it does appear that the virus, when it becomes resistant, doesn't replicate as well. It doesn't cause disease as readily. And so it's hopeful that the resistance won't be as big a problem with that virus, although it has been seen not only with human influenza, as shown here, but also now there have been some instances of resistance emergence in H5N1 patients who have been treated with the drug. So this is obviously an area of concern and ongoing study. Of course, another issue with the drug is having enough available. And there's been a lot of attention paid to the issue of stockpiling, in particular personal stockpiles. And I should just tell you that all the groups that I've interfaced with, including the Infectious Disease Society of America, has recommended strongly against personal stockpiles of the drug, in part because it will provide a real problem with access to drug for those who absolutely need it for both seasonal influenza and perhaps in a pandemic setting. But there is a limited production capacity here. And if we don't have these drugs on the shelf, we will not be able to have a surge in production in response to a pandemic. So stockpiling is going to be essential. In this regard, there are over 25 countries, I think over 30 countries, that have developed antiviral stockpiles. 10 have ordered or have actually received enough drug to treat anywhere from 20 to 40% of their population. The World Health Organization will have, by mid-2006, access to a 3 million course stockpile to try to attempt that strategy of pandemic containment. And I should add that even if it doesn't succeed in stopping the pandemic outbreak, extinguishing it, it may serve to delay it by a month or two, which could buy us valuable time in terms of developing a vaccine. Oseltamivir production capacity has increased fourfold over the last several years, and it's supposed to double again in 2006, but still it's going to take us a number of years, roughly a decade, and a lot of money. It's 14 billion euros is, I think, roughly about 16 to 18 billion U.S. to produce enough oseltamivir to treat 20% of the world's population. What about us in the United States and our stockpiling situation? Well, the pandemic plan that was released in November has a target of 81 million courses overall, plus another 6 million courses for containment, either domestically or at an international level. It also has a stipulation, unfortunately, of shared federal and state procurement. In other words, it doesn't pay for all that drug. It's going to ask the states to pay for a substantial portion of it, which I personally think is a mistake. Currently, though, we have a stockpile of 2.3 million courses of oseltamivir. This is scheduled to increase about double by the end of this year, and there's an announced intent to purchase an additional 20 million courses. However, if you think about our population being close to 300 million, an attack rate of 30%, really we're talking about 90 million affected individuals. So clearly, if we're only at 4 million now, that means that we have a small amount of drug and that we're going to have to really grapple with difficult rationing issues. There's a small amount of zanamivir, an inhaled form available, and 5 million courses of rimantadine. The problem is that the H5 virus that's caused the bulk of human infections in Thailand and Vietnam is resistant to the older class of antiviral drugs. So we can't rely on it currently, and that's really an unfortunate circumstance. How will the drug be used? Well, the National Vaccine Advisory Committee has weighed in on this, and this is a listing of their priority groups so that initially, depending on how much drug is available, it would be targeted to hospitalized patients, also to healthcare workers who develop influenza illness to try to, again, moderate the severity of their illness and allow them to continue to work so that our healthcare system doesn't degenerate in terms of its capacities. And then you can see various groups listed, including higher risk outpatients, but the biggest group is down at the bottom. That's other outpatients where we get up to that roughly 90 million figure that I talked about. I would just say that if it's a 1918-like event where there was clearly very high mortality with case fatality rates of 2% or higher in young and middle-aged adults, or if it's an H5-like virus where we're seeing a lot of mortality in otherwise healthy children and young adults, we're going to need enough drug to treat all of the individuals who are affected. So let me conclude then with a quotation from Alfred Crosby's book, one of the better ones that's appeared on the issue of pandemic influenza, although it's really not America's forgotten pandemic anymore. It's getting appropriate attention. In this, he said, influenza is one of God's cleverest tricks. The deity seems to have posed himself a paradoxical problem. Just how deadly a disease can I create that humans will barely notice? He's referring to seasonal or epidemic influenza. On the whole, we humans are more frightened with high mortality rates, which you're not apt to get, than of diseases with low but quite real mortality rates, which you're almost certain to get eventually. I put this in to remind us about the problem of regular influenza. We lose about 36,000 Americans each year on average to flu. There are several hundred thousand hospitalizations. I'm sure that almost everybody in this room has gotten their flu vaccine. If you haven't, this is a reminder to please take care of that right away. So thank you for your attention.
Who would like to start the conversation? When you please wait for Lauren to bring the microphone.
It looks like the guilty party is the migratory birds. Where and how do the migratory birds get the disease?
Yeah, the virus actually has migratory birds as its primary reservoir. So our human influenza virus is initially probably derived from avian viruses in migratory birds. Now, what's happened here is with H5 is a little bit different scenario. The migratory birds, when they travel and contaminate the environment of poultry, again, can spread that virus to the poultry. What's happened, that virus has now changed in the domestic poultry and gone back into the migratory birds, who are now carrying it to other parts of the world. So you've had this unique interaction where the virus has, again, gone from one species to another and then back into the original species. So if you culture birds, and this is being done on a regular basis now in different sentinel spots in North America, or even sample the water of lakes where the birds are, traveling through and defecating, and you'll get plenty of influenza viruses. There are lots of avian influenza viruses out there, but they don't generally cause disease in the birds. They replicate innocuously in the gut. They don't cause human infections. It's only after the virus undergoes adaptation to this highly pathogenic foul plague type that it can cause disease in poultry, and then is with H5 gone back into the migratory birds.
When the H5N1 virus reaches North America, do you think it's better to, when there's an outbreak, to kill the chickens off in that vicinity or to use a vaccine?
Yeah, good question about controlling virus in veterinary situations. Historically, the major focus has been on culling the birds, killing the affected population and hopefully eliminating the virus. The problem with H5 is that it's now become endemic in wide portions of the world, and as I mentioned, it's likely to become so in other portions as we look forward. People are still trying to do the mass culling in Europe and Russia, Ukraine, but it's not clear if that's going to succeed or not. So that in the longer term, I think it's going to be a combination of both strategies. We're definitely going to need to look at veterinary vaccines and as well as attempts to destroy affected flocks before they again can allow the virus to keep adapting and then spread to other birds and potentially to humans. So that'll be a combination of both of those kinds of strategies as we go forward. You're going to see a lot more use of veterinary vaccines in other parts of the world, and I think once it gets to North America here as well. We have one advantage in that much of our poultry production has substantial biosecurity already. Unfortunately, as you know, the birds are inside often. There's little free-range poultry that's produced relative to the large commercial factories, whereas in Asia, it's the opposite. There are a large portion of the birds that are produced are in backyard smallhold lots, and so it's very hard to keep the birds from getting exposed to the migratory fowl.
You said that person-to-person transfer was really necessary for this to really become a pandemic. How would we know if that is beginning to happen?
There are several sentinel surveillance efforts in place. Most of the affected countries have systems in place with village health workers to try to do surveys of both poultry outbreaks as well as unexplained human illnesses, particularly unexplained deaths or pneumonia events. It varies from country to country in terms of how good those surveillance networks are. In each of the countries, there's also then a linkage between the World Health Organization and the relevant Ministry of Health to try to get access to the data. But I can tell you that timely sharing of data has been a real problem. You saw it with SARS in China, and it's still probably playing out to some extent with influenza. Hopefully, this will be rectified in the near term, because we obviously, if there's any hope of the pandemic containment strategy working, you have to have virtually real-time surveillance and reporting going on.
Dr. Jones?
I'm having trouble understanding the immune mechanism against the viruses. The viruses enter the cells. Do we have antibodies inside the cells?
There are several immune responses that are induced by natural human influenza as well as by vaccines. When the virus infects a cell, it will actually expose its proteins on the surface of the cell during the assembly process as the virus is leaving. So that is an opportunity for our antibodies to attack, to attack the virus at that stage. Also, if it leaves the cell and is in, let's say, respiratory secretions, the antibodies can attack the free virus. There are other immune responses, including cellular immunity, that can, again, go after cells that are infected by the virus, so that there are an array of immune responses that are induced by both natural infection as well as vaccines. Again, our current injected vaccines primarily rely on antibodies directed against the hemagglutinin component that's, again, on the surface of the virus, but also on the surface of virally infected cells.
Sir.
Is Tamiflu available as an over-the-counter product or only by prescription?
Tamiflu, also Tamiflu, is only available by prescription. All of the influenza drugs that I mentioned are prescription only. It's interesting that there are some countries that are actually reviewing the possibility of making it into a over-the-counter a product. I think we need a lot more information before we could seriously consider that in the United States. Right now, the problem really is one of production and availability. There's a real caution here, though. In China, the older drug, amantadine, the M2 inhibitor, was actually made readily available. Put into a number of over-the-counter colds treatments, and also by report into some animal feed to try to control avian influenza. The problem was that this then generated an enormous amount of drug resistance, so that we know now that isolates of human influenza virus from China, Hong Kong, in the last few years, over 70% of them show resistance to that class of drugs. It's no longer effective. So that you have to be cautious about using these drugs appropriately, because there is the potential for generating resistance that can spread at a community level.
Just a logical follow-up question is, did you bring your prescription pad with you? Peter.
Does this affect small birds, either wild or pets? And if it doesn't, do we know why it doesn't?
Terrific question. People are now doing surveillance of small birds, and there have been some reports of detecting virus in sparrows and other peridomestic birds. And it's uncertain, really, what the dynamics are within the different bird populations. Obviously, the focus has been primarily on the big migratory birds and ducks and chickens and turkeys and things like that. But I think that there'll be more information coming out in the near term about the possible involvement of some of these other smaller birds that have close association with humans around the household. So I think they may be a real risk.
Mr. Davis?
Fred, that was a great talk. The virus is highly lethal on its own. But in past epidemics and pandemics, secondary bacterial infections have played a huge role in mortality. What it, You haven't mentioned that, and I'm just wondering how much secondary bacterial infections may play a role in the future, and how are we doing on susceptibility and antibiotics for those infections?
That's an important point, and I would just recall what happened in 57, where we had pretty good virology and microbiology available to us, unlike 1918. First human influenza virus wasn't isolated until 1933, so we don't really know exactly all the causes of death back in 1918. But in 57, about 25 to 30% of the lethal pneumonias were just virus, as far as we can tell. And the rest were either secondary bacterial infections or a combination of virus and bacteria. And the most common pathogens we would see then, and even now in epidemics of flu, would be Streptococcus pneumoniae, the pneumococcus, Haemophilus influenza, and Staph aureus. Now, as you're well aware, the pneumococcus has become increasingly resistant to some common antibiotics. And particularly with Staph aureus, there's a real concern now that we're seeing community spread of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus that we are in a situation where they could see really lethal pneumonias of that community-acquired methicillin-resistant Staph aureus coming on top of influenza. And there's actually a biologic basis for that, in part that the bacteria makes a protease that helps enhance the infectivity of the virus. So this is a so-called perfect storm, then, if you will, of viral bacterial interaction. And it means that some of our conventional antibiotics are not nearly as useful, and we'll be looking at treatments that'll be require intravenous administration or very expensive antibiotics. So that I'm very concerned again about this possibility of drug-resistant secondary bacterial infections on top of flu that's already been seen in epidemic flu. Remember when Fujian came through in 2003-04, we had reports of pediatric deaths. I think there were 153 that were reported across the country. A number of those were due to these secondary bacterial infections, and some with drug-resistant organisms.
Richard, people like ourselves run the risk of aggravating the problem of production and supply of Tamiflu for the sake of purely personal protection and prophylaxis. What do you advise?
Yeah. No, I advise against that. In fact, the pandemic plan that we have is really focusing on treatment of ill persons. Bear in mind that for prophylaxis, you have to take the drug on a daily basis for periods of anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 or 10 weeks, as long as the virus is around, because it only works while you take it. That takes an enormous amount of drug. It's a very inefficient way to use a valuable resource. So our goal is to get enough drug to treat individuals as early as possible in their illness and reduce their likelihood of having complications. And right now, again, there are alternatives for epidemic influenza that it is susceptible to both classes of drugs. And I would urge individuals to consult with their physicians regarding alternatives. But of course, still the primary means of protection is vaccine. So make sure that you've got that.
Of eating the flesh of these migratory birds that people hunt, and are their eggs affected?
If these products are appropriately cooked, there's no threat at all. The virus is readily inactivated by heat. So the problem has been there have been a few human cases in Vietnam where it looked like they've got infected because they ingested, raw duck blood. Or undercooked poultry. I'm told by my veterinary colleagues that the eggs, the surface of the eggs, can certainly be contaminated by infectious virus, so that, you know, washing and proper cooking is necessary. And perhaps the last egg or two that's produced by a sick bird might have virus inside as well. I don't know. I haven't seen the data, though. But in general, proper cooking will eliminate the risk, and that, of course, again, means hard-boiled eggs.
I just wanted to ask on the front end about surveillance and testing. How would we know whether it was that or just a common cold, bronchitis? And on the back end, quarantine.
Well, in terms of pandemic influenza, you'll have an enormous amount of media coverage if there are clusters of human cases that are suspect in terms of this virus starting to take off in the human population. There'll be announcements from the World Health Organization, from the Centers for Disease Control. There'll be no shortage of information. I didn't get into clinical details, but all the cases of H5N1 so far in humans have had a typical flu-like illness at the beginning with fever, headache, often cough, sometimes diarrhea, that then after about 5 to 7 days evolves into a lower respiratory tract phase with progressive viral pneumonia. So it's really completely different than a common cold kind of picture with a runny nose and sneezing and mild sore throat. This is a pretty serious infection at the beginning.
2 weeks ago, Matt Simmons was here and warned that we have much less oil than we've been led to believe. Last week, the Undersecretary of State was here to warn that it's very likely that Iran is perfecting nuclear weaponry. We've had this very sobering assessment today. This is annual giving time, and we are not trying to scare people off. The demands on Dr. Hayden are enormous. We are very grateful for his generosity in being here today. Thank you very much.